Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of the book of Genesis. We're in Genesis 32. We've come to verse 12 specifically. It's the narrative about Jacob meeting Esau, but it's really a narrative about Jacob overcoming fear and trusting completely in God. Jacob had sent messengers to Esau advising him of his approach, coming back into the promised land after a 20-year absence from his homeland, dwelling in Mesopotamia, where he had now acquired two wives and a large family. He didn't know what the disposition of Esau was going to be. Was Esau going to be a man mellowed out, or was he going to be still hostile with murderous intentions? Jacob had come a long way. God was doing a work in Jacob's life, just like he does in our lives. Not exactly in the same ways, and of course the stakes were not on the same scale as far as history was concerned, but personally. So Jacob, in fear, is appealing to God. In verse 10, Jacob approaches God, and this is the new Jacob, and this is the humble Jacob. I'll actually start back in verse 9. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac. He's not praying to any God. He's praying to the living God, the only God, and the God in whom the faith of his father Abraham and Isaac had been reposed. You said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. Jacob is banking on that promise, but still guilt, residual guilt, in his treatment of Esau has him caught up in the coils of fear. I'm unworthy, verse 10, of all the loving kindness and all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I've become two companies. Jacob knows who's responsible for that. So in faith, he turns to the Lord and asks him to deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, for I fear him. He has faith, but his faith is seated with fear. How familiar that is to all of us. I fear him lest he come and attack me, mother and children. For thou didst say, verse 12, I will surely prosper you, and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. It pleases God, folks, when our trust in him is anchored in his explicit promises, when our confidence in his faithfulness to perform his word flows out of our hearts and into our mouths. Jacob has seen God's provision for the last 20 years in the case of Laban. Likewise, Jacob has seen God's protection from the scheming and the conniving Laban. Jacob's faith is not a confidence in God pulled out of the thin air. It is a faith based upon revelation. It is a faith based upon explicit divine promises. And it's a faith enhanced and enriched and deepened by undeniable performance of all of those promises, just like your faith, just like my faith. It's not a spirit of hopeful optimism that we just generate within ourselves. No, it's based upon all of those foundations. Well, in verse 13, after that prayer, we read, so Jacob spent the night there. Then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau. What was that present? Well, in terms of the economy of that day, very rich indeed. 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 lambs, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. And in verse 16, he delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by itself. And he said to his servants, here are your instructions. Pass on before me and put a space between the droves. And he commanded the one in front, saying, when my brother Esau meets you, and he asks you, saying, to whom do you belong? Where are you going? And to whom do these animals in front of you belong? Then I want you to say, verse 18, these belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau. Behold, he is also behind us. Then he commanded also the second and the third, and all of those who followed the droves. After this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him, and you shall say, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us. For Jacob said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. He's still afraid of a hostile encounter. Faith is wrestling with fear. So the present passed on before him while he himself spent that night in the camp. Jacob forms a well-laid plan. Jacob had good knowledge of human nature. To mollify or soften, hopefully, any hostile intent on the part of his twin Esau, he sends before him a very generous procession of gifts at well-spaced intervals. He hoped that for a cumulative effect on Esau's passions, if they remained. Each gift was preceded by his servants. These two verses, verses 14 and 15, itemize the largesse from his flocks and herds that Jacob was contributing to Esau. Clearly, Jacob was not skimping, for out of his God-given wealth he was donating to Esau a number of flocks and herds fit for a king. Some of this, of course, is out of guilt, and some of this, of course, is out of fear. He's trying to do humanly whatever he can to soften any harsh feelings that still remain with Esau. So he instructs his servants to space out the procession of flocks and herds for effect. To my mind, Jacob is no longer conniving, but the good side of a conniving character, if there's any residue of virtue, is shrewdness. Jacob never lost his shrewdness. Grace scrapes away the bad, leaves the good, and turns it for the service of God. That shrewdness we now see in his careful instruction to his servants. He anticipates Esau's questions to his servants. He tells them how to answer, right down to finally assuring Esau that Jacob is bringing up the rear. There's no guessing about Jacob's thinking, he tells us. I hope to pacify him with these gifts I'm sending ahead. Later, when I see him, perhaps he will be inclined to receive me. So in verse 21, Jacob's gifts went on ahead of him, but he himself spent the night in the camp. And here things really get interesting. It appears that Jacob set this procession of servants and gifts in motion during the night, but that is unclear, and it's unimportant for us to decide. The more important observation for us here is just this. However he orchestrated the caravan, he himself spent the night in the camp. This would be a fateful night in the life of Jacob. This would mark a major spiritual turning point. In verses 22 and 23, the narrator, Moses, elaborates the sequence of events. That night, Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok River, that is. After he had sent them across the stream at a fording place, he sent over all his possessions. The Jabbok River would later form the boundary between Gad and Reuben, flowing west down the defile between the mountains into the Jordan River, approximately 20 miles north of the Dead Sea. In verse 24, it appears that once the transition was made, as I mentioned a bit earlier, Jacob returned to the east side, adjacent to the Jabbok River. There he just wanted to be alone. There's no other plausible reason. Why did he do that? And during that time, we read, a man wrestled him until daybreak. From verses 25 through 30, it is clear that the man with whom Jacob wrestled was the presence of God, veiled in human flesh, something like the incarnation, except temporary. It was a real person, not just a mental wrestling. It was a physical as well as a spiritual wrestling. Now, as others have remarked, Jacob's whole adult life had been to this point marked by struggle, a struggle with people. You might be able to relate to that. There was a struggle in the home with Esau. There was a struggle with Isaac, and then with Laban back in Paddan Aram. A struggle with the domestic rivalry of his two wives. A struggle with Laban in Gilead. Now coming back to his homeland, here he is facing potential and possibly a deadly struggle with his brother Esau. One crisis after another, as Jacob, in his default mode, sought by wile and wits to win. His real struggle, though Jacob does not know it yet, it's often that way with us too, his real struggle is with God. It appears in this narrative that God took the initiative to conform Jacob to his will. That's what he always does in shaping and sanctifying his servants. What we appear to have here in verses 25 through 30 is a struggle that went on until daybreak, as we are told. It's as a lion play fighting with a cub, or with a father play wrestling with a young son, scales down his fatherly strength to proportion for the benefit of the exercise, yet sending the message who is really in control. Well, God allows Jacob in this form of a theophany to wrestle with him. In the process, God dislocated Jacob's hip with a bare touch. That sent a loud message who Jacob is tangling with. In the end, it allows Jacob to win by his dogged determination the blessing that by this time Jacob came to understand only God could give. So what was that struggle all about? Jacob was like a guy who had won his way to the top by his will and wits and wiles. As we mentioned, that was sort of Jacob's default mode. Could be yours. At the end of the day, despite the backing of previous divine promises, Jacob's barking conscience was not clear with respect to his stripping of Esau 20 years before. I've mentioned this again and again. Jacob did not feel his hands entirely clean because of his two-decade-old deceptiveness. Now he finds himself facing a vulnerable situation where Esau, and he doesn't know what Esau's mindset is coming his way with 400 armed men, and they may be coming to strip him. And because his conscience was not secure, all that conscience, his confidence in God's blessing was not secure either. A bad conscience can really rattle the cage of faith. This must be dealt with. Would he lose all the blessing Jacob had gained to force restitution at the hands of Esau and his 400 forces? Would it all fall into the hands of his offended brother? Well, the man with whom he is wrestling in verses 25 through 30 is forcing Jacob's conflicted soul. Is Jacob willing to just let it all go? Is he willing to give up trying to gain and maintain God's blessing through his own designs? Can Jacob just be content to do his due diligence and let go and simply trust God to fulfill God's promises of provision and protection and multiplication, no matter what Esau had in mind? That's what's going on here. That is a huge crisis. A crisis of faith, a crisis of fear, in the case of Jacob. God is breaking Jacob down in terms of any more dependence on Jacob's own strength and strategies to make it happen. This is one of those let go and let God struggles that will define Jacob hereafter. You may have had, you may be having, one of those very struggles yourself. In the end, Jacob will receive a new name. That new name will memorialize this major shift in his mode of mental operation. I think there is in this whole scenario something more specific that is usually not mentioned. Jacob, as we know, won Esau's birthright. That he did not win by deception. What he had done was capitalize on a weak moment in the case of Esau. It was sort of like taking a penny from a person in a hurry who did not realize it was a rare coin worth $1 million. Then, at his mother's insistence, he colluded to deceive his father Isaac into blessing Jacob instead of Esau. Now, Jacob had the birthright. In addition, he had the prophetic blessing that legally belonged to Esau, both of which God had intended all along for Jacob to have, but not by those methods. The problem was this. Jacob did not come into possession of either honorably, but craftily. As a result, we remind ourselves there was this rip and tear in his relationship with his brother Esau. And now, whoa, Esau is bearing down on him, and all of that is coming up on his conscience like acid reflux. Even though God chose Jacob, not Esau, to inherit the patriarchal blessings, God wanted those blessings to come about his way, not Jacob's way, not his mother's way, not through any conniving or scheming. As a result of all that baggage, and despite all God's promises, we find Jacob here facing he knows not what reception from his wounded brother. And though he has become a man of faith, in verse 7, we remind ourselves that he was in great fear and distress. How many times have I said it? A bad conscience has a way of undercutting our confidence before God and his promises. That boil needs to be lanced. And that can only happen if Jacob, who so badly wants God to bless him, yields and puts himself and his fortunes completely in God's hands, forgets his fear, faces Esau like a man of God, not a man of guile. Here, I believe, is the story, or the essence of Jacob's wrestling with God in human form. God seems against him, seems to be resisting Jacob, yet Jacob desperately wants reassurance of God's blessing upon his life. In the face of his imminent meeting with a possibly still very angry Esau, Jacob clings to the man, and he will not let go of God, who has wounded Jacob by a mere touch, until God promises to bless him. He knows everything hinges upon God's blessing. This is growth. In the process, it appears that Jacob, in his wrestling with God, came at last to understand that his future and his blessing and his inheritance was not owing now or in the future to himself in any way, shape, or form. He's finally realized that it is strictly owing to the promise and power and blessing of God. And once Jacob got hold of that, Jacob was able to put everything in the hands of his sovereign God, able to mentally agree to let Esau do what Esau would, let Esau have his way, whatever it was. And even if Esau stripped him like a tree of all of its branches, Jacob now comes to the point that he would trust God to bless him and to make all things work together for good. That, folks, I believe, is what all the wrestling with God was all about. Jacob that night had to give up everything, in principle, that he had acquired, partly through deception, then through hard work. Mentally, he had to give it all to Esau in advance, if that was God's plan, and come to terms with just letting go and let God work everything out, come what will, just seeking and trusting in God's blessing. Well, in verses 26, when the man saw that he could not overpower Jacob, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. The man, as we've already noted, is God in a theophany, wrestling with Jacob in a human form, as we said earlier. It is God reducing himself like a father wrestling with his very young son, reduced to scale. But Jacob was a powerful, fit man who did not yield easily in this contest, not even when the Lord with a mere touch dislocated his hip. In Jacob's determination to secure God's blessing, anticipating that he was perhaps about to forfeit all God had given him to Esau. When the man asked Jacob to release him, "Let me go, for it is daybreak," Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." That response is how we know that Jacob had finally figured out that this one with whom he had spent all night wrestling was the Lord, reduced to a man for this fateful encounter. The man asked him, "What is your name?" That was to focus Jacob's attention on his old nature, reflected in his given name. "Jacob," he answered. Well, verse 28, going forward, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel." Why Israel? Because of its meaning. You have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome. Israel means one who struggles with God. How can Jacob be said to overcome God of all things? Only in the sense that Jacob, in his despair and fear, would not let go of God until he won from the Lord the assurance of his gracious blessing, despite all the terror he was facing. He wanted that so he could go forth in confidence to meet Esau, come what will, knowing that he, Jacob, was going to come out of all of this, no matter what went down, with God having his back. Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But the man replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. To know one's name was to ask for a very familiar knowledge of someone. As in the case of Moses, we can know God really and truly, but never fully, for our minds cannot begin to contain or comprehend all that he is. We can, as the Lord explained to Moses, only see, figuratively speaking, the backside of the Lord as he passes by, not full in the face, as it were, for that knowledge is too great and wonderful for us. So, our knowledge of God may be fully true as far as it goes, even as mature believers, but never truly full. We must always understand that, and it will help keep us humble before God. Pity those who in their conceit imagine themselves so mature in spiritual things that they can no longer see themselves as learners, but view themselves as teachers who have mastered the knowledge of God. That was one of the big problems with Job's friends. They thought they had the knowledge of God dialed in, but in the end they proved far more ignorant of him than they ever imagined. "Why do you ask my name?" is a question that implies, "Jacob, by now, do you even need to ask?" Thereupon, when God formally bestowed his blessing upon Jacob, under the circumstances where Jacob anticipates he's about to forfeit everything he owns, given his sin against Esau and Isaac, and have to start from scratch, God's blessing is his assurance that no matter what, Jacob, nothing has changed. "I said I would bless you, and bless you I will. So just go forward in the blind and depend upon me." Jacob got it, and to memorialize it, to make a monument of this life-changing encounter with God, he names the place Peniel, the face of God, because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared. For him, that place would forever mark the place where he met God as never before, and his whole relationship with God dramatically changed from a user of God to a true worshiper of God to a humble dependent upon God. Face to face, we must remember, speaks of a very personal encounter. God is pure spirit, John 4. He's not a corporeal being, but as pure spirit, he cannot be seen in his essence, for that would be consumptive for mortal man. Still, he can and did, in the case of Moses and Jacob, manifest himself in a very intimate way, in a form that Jacob could find no better way to describe than face to face. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.